Hi, this is Lee Allen. Some of you and I are old friends. We met around some radio speaker, some television tube, some show, some dance, or maybe we're meeting for the first time. As a boy, radio was another world to me. I could sit by the radio and get lost in the programs. Yes, they were programs. Whole stories. Nobody ever heard of disc jockeys in those days. DJs were at least 10 years away. Radio was wonderful. It was filled with adventure, comedy, drama, heroes, and suspense. I would listen and imagine. The action, voices, and places were real to me. So real that there were pictures in my mind. I could see them all. Superman could fly. Not the television Superman. My Superman. The creaking door of the inner sanctum was 100 feet tall and filled with cobwebs. The shadow was invisible. But I knew he was really Lamont Cranston, and I could see him. Programs with names like The Green Hornet, Challenge of the Yukon, Blondie, Gunsmoke, Mr. Keene, Tracer of Lost Persons. My favorite program was The Lone Ranger. Mom didn't want me to listen to The Lone Ranger, though. Too much blood and guts, she would say. There were others on her no-no list, but whenever I could, I listened anyway. The Lone Ranger was created and broadcast in Detroit. So was The Green Hornet and Challenge of the Yukon. You might remember that one if I told you it was all about Sergeant Preston of the Canadian Mounted Police and his husky dog King. I can still hear him. On, King, on, you husky. I had a perfect picture of all of them in my mind. They were absolutely real. Bigger than life, stronger than anyone, and invincible. One night, my mom and dad took my sister and I out to dinner at a restaurant they frequented. A lot of Detroit movers and shakers went there. The restaurant in Detroit was always jammed, and this night was no exception. I can clearly remember my dad saying to me that the Lone Ranger just walked in. "Did I want to meet him?" he asked. And then, pushing through the crowd with me in tow, my dad stopped at a table near the back of the restaurant. One of the men stood up, and my dad introduced me. I was devastated. I was hoping it wasn't a joke. My dad was always a nice man and very kind to me, so I knew it wasn't. The reason? The man's name was Earl Grauser. He was the actor who played the Lone Ranger on the radio, and he was short and fat. The Lone Ranger, short and fat. Well, my little world crashed that night. The program originated from WXYZ Radio in Detroit. Earl Grauser played the part on the air, but he never appeared anywhere in person as the Lone Ranger. Personal appearances were done by the program's deep-voiced announcer, Brice Beamer. The actor who played Tonto never appeared in person as Tonto either. His name was John Todd. He was not an Indian. He was an older man, Caucasian, a Shakespearean actor, and a professor at Wayne University in Detroit. He looked nothing like the Lone Ranger's faithful companion. I never met him. In a way, that's a good thing. To me, he was Tonto. Beamer was tall, slim, good-looking, and the perfect Lone Ranger. Grauser was only the voice. Not long after that, there was a terrible night. Earl Grauser was killed in a car crash. His voice was stilled. Funny, though, I heard about it, but never believed that the Lone Ranger was dead or would ever die. In spite of Mom's orders, I found a way to listen to the next program after the crash. In it, the Lone Ranger was wounded and couldn't speak. It seemed like weeks before he recovered and we began to hear his voice again. Slowly, with each succeeding program, the voice emerged, deeper, stronger, more resonant than ever. This only confirmed my belief that the Lone Ranger was immortal. It was true that Earl Grauser died in that crash, but the Lone Ranger didn't. The new voice introduced to the radio audience ever so slowly was that of the announcer, Brace Beamer. He not only sounded like the Lone Ranger, but he looked like him, dressed like him, owned an actual ranch in Oxford, Michigan, just outside of Detroit, and had horses there. One of them was a white stallion. The stallion's name was Silver. Until his death in 1964, Brace Beamer not only played the part on the radio, he was the Lone Ranger. He believed his part. That was the year I finally came face to face with my boyhood hero. Not long after I met him at Broadcast House, WXYZ in Detroit, Brace Beamer was dead. But to this day, the Lone Ranger lives. In 1985, I had a phone call from my friend Dick Osgood, a broadcast pioneer in Detroit. 37 years at WXYZ, the first face on Channel 7, author of Wixie Wonderland, the whole story of WXYZ, and the Lone Ranger, and the first face on Channel 7 in Detroit. Well, we got together and we voted, and you're it. Who got together and what did you vote on, and what it am I? I said. Dick went on to explain that there was going to be a performance of the Lone Ranger at the Friends of Old Time Radio in New Jersey, and the Lone Ranger actors got together and voted that I would play the Lone Ranger. In a moment, you'll hear Dick explain the whole thing in his own voice. The recording, done in 1985, has been lost for over 30 years. In this recording, Tonto is played by Rube Weiss, a famous actor and voice in Detroit. You may have seen him on television with Soupy Sales as Shoutin' Shorty Hogan. You may have heard hundreds of his commercials. Or maybe, just maybe, you went to the Thanksgiving Day Parade at Hudson's in downtown Detroit and saw Santa Claus, otherwise known as Rube Weiss. Rube's wife Liz is also an actor in this Lone Ranger. You'll hear the voice of Fred Foy, the famous announcer. Whit Vernon and Carol Vernon also act in this version of the Lone Ranger. And one of the original Lone Ranger actors, Harry Goldstein, is in the cast. All of those voices are now stilled, but in this priceless recording, they're still with us, alive, well, and active again. Oh, one more thing. In 1964, I was on WXYZ Radio in Detroit, in my office at Broadcast House, and I heard this voice. I turned to my television partner, Joel Sebastian, and I said, "My gosh, Joel, it's the Lone Ranger." I didn't say Brace Beamer. I said the Lone Ranger. Well, I went outside the office, and there he was, in his 60s, looking to me like the Lone Ranger should look in his 60s. And I got to meet him. I shook his hand. I was nervous. We had some small talk, and he gave me a silver bullet, which I have to this day. So, here we go. 1985, never broadcast, except now to you, when I had the chance to play the part of my boyhood hero, the Lone Ranger. Rube Weiss will introduce Dick Osgood. Dick will talk about the history of radio, the origin of the Lone Ranger. Rube will then introduce the cast, and then the actual performance. This is Lee Allen. Thanks for listening.
Good evening. Tonight's program is divided into three parts. Part one will feature longtime Detroit radio personality Dick Osgood. The author of Wixie, he will discuss early radio in Detroit. I would be remiss if I did not mention that last week Mr. Osgood received an Emmy as a pioneer Detroit broadcaster from the National Academy of Television Arts and Science. Part two will feature Rube and Liz Weiss. They and their cast will present a recreation of an original Lone Ranger broadcast. Recently, Mr. Weiss received an award from Advertising Age for the best commercial of 1985. Part three will be a question and answer period. Before proceeding with the program, I would like to extend the club's gratitude to Dick Osgood, Rube and Liz Weiss and cast, and Sonny Elliott. I hope you enjoy the program. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Rube Weiss, and an old friend of mine is Dick Osgood, who has been a broadcaster in Detroit for many years, WXYZ, radio and television both. He was president of the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists for a number of years, and the author of Wixie Wonderland, which is a complete history of WXYZ from its very beginning until today almost. So it's with a great deal of pleasure that I introduce to you now Dick Osgood.
Right about here, you can hear me. Isn't that wonderful? I've been asked to talk about old-time radio, and I feel that I would be remiss if I did not mention briefly the father of radio, the man in history who is known as the father of radio. Does anybody here know who that was?
Sonny Elliott.
Well, if he's the father, I'm the grandfather. Now, I want to tell you briefly that in 1899, a fellow 26 years old was wiring switchboards for Westinghouse in Chicago. He was eking out a living. He had to go without food in order to raise money to go to the Chicago Opera. He loved opera, had inherited it. And he was also experimenting with something which was called a wireless telegraphy or a wireless telephone sort of thing. And he thought, the greatest thing in the world, next to heaven, is music. And how wonderful it would be if he could just get opera, get those great singers into the homes of people. And this haunted him, and he kept working at it. And in 1904, at the St. Louis World's Fair, he erected a kind of a tower, and he won the grand prize at that St. Louis World's Fair, by sending a message without wires from St. Louis to Chicago. People would stand under this tower, and they'd look up to see that message go out, and they couldn't see that message go out. One woman said, it's a fake. He's calling it wireless because he's strung a thread from here to Chicago. He's sending it over a thread. About 2 years later, he came up with an improvement, a new invention, and some entrepreneurs in New York wanted to sell this, sell stock in it, and market it. And they were put on trial. And I want to quote what the judge said to the jury toward the end of this trial. Let me tell you, gentlemen of the jury, they are preying on the minds of simple people. This device is without merit. It is a piece of glass which has been built into the form of a lamp, not to perform scientific wonders, but to sell stock. It was the Audion tube, and I'm not going to get technical because I'm not technical, but it was the heart of what became the radio telephone. The gentlemen who were on trial went to jail. The inventor went out to Chicago, went to San Francisco, and got a job with the telephone company. And in 1900, now let me get, I take notes because I, as an ex-newsman, I like to have things correct. Now wait a minute. I want to get the date right. He came to, things began to go on at the Metropolitan Opera House. And it was in 1910. And Gaddi Kazaza was in the Impresario. And he was a very temperamental man and a very much of a dictator. And they were afraid to let him know what was going on. But they did. He did see that these people were fooling around with putting things down in the footlights. So they had to explain themselves. If he'd known what was going on in the attic, he would have stopped them. But they said, sir, we would like to bring the opera up to your office so that you wouldn't have to come out to watch the opera. You could check on it in your office and hear the opera and hear what was going on there. What they were actually doing was installing things to pick up sound down in the footlights, and up in the attic they had other paraphernalia. And on the roof of the Metropolitan Opera House, the old one in New York, they were erecting fishing poles. And on the date has been controversial, but the inventor himself said it was January 13, 1910. Was I right? Yes, I was right. Imagine the reaction of wireless operators on ships entering New York Harbor, suddenly losing the dot dash of the Morse code and hearing Enrico Caruso singing I Pagliacci. Can you imagine what they must have thought? That was the first real public broadcast. The name of the inventor, of course, was Lee DeForest. He still had bad luck. He went to Germany and worked with putting sound to movies. This is way back around 1910, a little later. Meanwhile, while he was away, this thing began to mushroom. Interest in this invention of his began to mushroom. And when he came back to the United States, he found himself to be quite a hero and quite a famous man. People had picked up his idea and were experimenting all over the country with it. In Detroit, James Scripps, who owned and published the Detroit News, gave a check for $1,000 to a man named Clark, who is a local inventor, to work with this thing, see if he could develop and get something out of it. But the big thing that happened in this town that really put the focus on this radio telephone thing was one of the first, I think it might have been the first, radio show in April 1922. Incidentally, I forgot to mention that the son of James Scripps put up a kind of a transmitting station, and he called it, where is it here? 8MK. Am I talking too loud? I see. 8MK. All right, then we come to the radio show in April 1922, and it was played up. The Detroit Free Press spent several pages on this marvel. The radio show was held on the fourth floor of the General Motors building, and there were the Free Press, I think, called it radio, or Detroit, the hub, the radio hub of America. Now, that's hard for us to imagine today, but it was true at that time. And the paper had reasons for saying it. There were 40 companies in Detroit alone making receiving sets. There were 60 companies in Detroit manufacturing parts for this new gadget. 20 Detroit furniture companies were building cabinets to put these receiving sets in. There were 100 wholesalers and retailers trying to market this thing in the Detroit area alone. 6 different displays in the radio show showed nothing but batteries. There was one man who had a specialty. He devoted his entire booth to selling people on the idea of having this thing that would receive whatever, news or music usually, in canoes. That was his specialty. Get them in canoes. I know that there was then, at that time, there was no such thing as a loudspeaker. And I claim the possibility that I might have invented the loudspeaker, because I was living in New York during this period, and I bought my first radio in a drugstore. And it came with directions of how to put it together. And it was a little thing, not very big, on a little kind of a board. And the way you tuned in was, there was a crystal on the top of this thing, and you took a little piece of wire. They called it the cat's whisker. And you'd take this little piece of wire, and you'd put it down in different places on the crystal until you got something, and it would come in. Well, this is fine. It came with just one pair of earphones. There were two of us living in the same place, and both of us wanted to hear this thing. And it was got kind of tiresome to take half of an earphone and have somebody else have half of an earphone. So I came up with the idea of getting a mixing bowl and throwing the earphones into the mixing bowl. And it was thought that if we were close enough, we could hear the show. So I really do claim. But it's interesting to me what people were saying about radio at that time. And if you'll excuse me, I'll show my 85 years and put on my glasses, because I want to read some of the things that were being said at that time, because I think it's interesting in light of what the world is today and what broadcasting is today. J.L. Hudson put a big ad in the newspaper which read, "Radio has been called an influence for democracy. People in towns and villages and those in desolate country places may share alike in its wide sphere of influence. Concerts by famous artists, sermons by great religious leaders, and all the features of life in metropolitan cities are carried through space to every place that a man calls his home." The Detroit News said the growth of interest and demand for equipment had not been equaled in any other industry. Now, this is in 1922, and the Free Press agreed with the Detroit News and said that even the automobile had not created as much interest years before, or even the bicycle before that. Nothing had created the interest that this radio phone, which shortly was called radio, had created. The public library had 350 copies, how-to copies alone, that people were borrowing to want to put these things together, these radio sets together, and as soon as they came in, they went right out again, 350 of them. Henry Joy, president of Packard Motor Company, and this, I think, is wonderful. This is in my book, and it's toward the end of the book, but I'm putting it up here early. He said, "When the Brotherhood of Man," now just listen to this, "when the Brotherhood of Man shall have reached the degree of perfection that national boundaries are no more, some historian of that distant period will record that radio was the first medium to disseminate the mode of thought that wiped narrowness from the minds of mankind." That was a vision, and it's still, I guess, kind of a distant time. Well, this brings us around at this to the number of stations that were in Detroit at that time, around 1922. KMK, 8MK had become WWJ. E.D. Stair of the Detroit Free Press had a station called WCX. WJR was on the air. It was owned by the Jewett Radio and Phonograph Company. WWI was owned by the Ford Motor Company and was used privately. There was also a station, WDYC, and you can guess what DYC stood for, Detroit Yacht Club. And what they did was send messages to their members who would be sailing up and down the Detroit River or driving their boats up and down Lake St. Clair. There was also a station in town at that time, 1922, which might have been one of the first of its kind. Initials were WKOP. And you know what KOP sounds like, and you're right, it was the Detroit Police Department. They owned possibly one of the first radio hookups in the country. There was also a station called WGHP, George Harrison Phelps. He was a wonder man who came to Detroit, was brought here by the Dodge brothers, who discovered him in New York, and he was very a very much a live wire, and they brought him into Detroit to create an advertising department for the Dodge brothers. And he did, I don't know if anybody was alive to remember, I was, there was a time when all Dodge needed to advertise itself was a huge billboard and one word on it against a background of cobalt blue, and this man right down here knows what the word was.
Dependable.
Dependable, you're right. And they didn't even have to put the word Dodge Brothers on it. Everybody just looked at that word, dependable, and they knew about the Dodge Brothers. That was George Harrison Phelps, and he thought it would be fun as a hobby to own a radio station. So he bought a house, and I've never been able to locate where that house was. It was between Grand River and downtown, and it was somewhere in the neighborhood of Brush and John R., and he set up his WGHP radio station in the carriage house. Well, he did very well with it, but he wasn't pleased with the signal, so he took the top floor of the Maccabees building. Now we have the story of the three Georges. George I was George Harrison Phelps. He went along fine until the Dodge brothers died, and the Dodge widows thought money was more attractive than the manufacturing plant, and they were willing to sell the Dodge plant, and it eventually went to a man named Chrysler, who promptly dropped George Harrison Phelps as his advertising man. And we now are in the middle of a depression. We're up to about 1932 or 3, somewhere in there, maybe a little bit earlier. We're in the depression anyway. So George Harrison Phelps, who had been picked by the Columbia Broadcasting System as the outlet in Detroit for CBS, the word got around that he was having problems, and CBS was worried about losing the outlet, and they contacted a man down in Toledo who had created a station called WSPD for Speedene, the name of a gasoline, not to be confused with high-speed gas, which sponsored me for some 20 or 30 years on WXYZ. Speedene. The man's name was George Number 2, George B. Storer. So he took a lease on WGHP and bought it. And he had it only 18 months when George the III entered the picture. George III was George Washington Trendle, and he was in the theater business. Actually, he was a lawyer and had become a partner of John Kunsky, who started with slot machines, graduated to movies, and by this time they had built and owned the Adams Theater, the Palm State Theater, the Michigan Theater, the United Artists Theater, the Madison Theater, and what was then the Broadway Capitol, later the Grand Circus Theater, not to mention theaters out in the outskirts. They were really big. But Trendle was unhappy, because a Chicago firm, Balaban and Katz, were kind of invading his territory. So he thought, he persuaded Kunsky to sell the theaters and get into this new thing called radio. So they changed when they bought it from Stora, George III, the partner, Kunsky, and they took with them a Howard Pierce, who had staged those mammoth, some of you remember them, I hope, some of those very lush stage shows that were put on the stages between movies. You remember those? Well, Howard Pierce staged those at the Michigan, and those shows traveled on the public circuit, New York, Paramount Theater, Chicago, and all over the place. So they thought they'd take Howard in as a showman. Well, I'm not going to spend too much time here. I want to get to the frosting on the cake here tonight. But Trendle was persuaded by a very shrewd sales manager he'd picked up from one of the newspapers. He had sold advertising in one of the newspapers. His name was H. Allen Campbell. I taped with them for the book, all of them, and each one passed the buck to the other. Howard Pierce to H. Allen Campbell, Campbell to Trendle. Trendle said Campbell, biggest mistake Campbell ever made. Campbell said he never had anything to do with it. It was the silliest thing they ever did. Anyhow, it was a big mistake. They dropped CBS, because they figured they could make more money selling local time than being tied up to a network. Well, we're still in the big depression. And the time, radio was very different. I have to explain to the young people here. There were, when I joined the station, 22 singers. There were at that time 4 pianists. There was a house orchestra of 13 people with Russ Morgan directing. There were 4 pianists on the staff, not to mention the announcers, the people who put the news together from the wire services, and it was a big staff of people, not to mention a large group of freelance actors, because Trendle had inherited a jewel from George Storer II. That was James Jewell, who was staging a half-hour drama every night. They were losing now $4,000 a week. So Trendle sat down with Mr. Kunsky and said, "You know, in the theaters, we never lost money with a Western." He said, "We made money with bad Westerns." And he said, "We made more money with a good Western." He says, "I'm going to put on a Western. We're going to have a Western on the radio." Thus arose the greatest controversy of all time in radio. I spent 3 years, taped 105 hours in California, Chicago, St. Louis, New York, Florida, and I got the story straight, and I'm not going to bore you with this now, but it finally turned out to be the Lone Ranger. There were two people. There was a man who was writing scripts that were being used here, and I was using them in Boston on the Yankee Network, called Warner Lester Manhunter. Very, very popular, written by a fellow in Buffalo named Fran Stryker. But when Trendle said, "I want a Western," Jewell wrote 2 or 3 of them. Trendle says, "I don't like them." So Jewell, naturally, being the dramatic director, thought of Fran Stryker, who was writing Warner Lester and others at that time, wrote to Fran. Fran had written a series called The Covered Wagon Days. His hero was a singing hero, lighthearted. Trendle's idea was a very serious man, standing for justice and decency, honesty. And eventually, Fran thought his Covered Wagon Days had been changed into The Lone Ranger by himself. Trendle really was the final made the final decision. It's interesting, and this is very quick. I'm going to get through with this fast, but it's kind of interesting, I think, to know that the horse was Trendle's idea. They wanted, in the committee meetings, they said, "Let's have an Arabian horse." And Trendle, who knew horses, said, "Nope, not big enough. Got to have a beautiful, great, big, white, high-stepping horse." And they named him Silver. All right. After a while, Trendle said, I'm kind of sick of hearing the narrator talk all the time and the Lone Ranger talking to the horse. We ought to have another character." Somebody said, "Let's have a girl." Trendle said, "No." Well, somebody said, "An Indian." Okay, they'd have an Indian, but Trendle said, "Always make him minor, a minor character." What did they name him? Stryker went to the map and found the Tonto Basin down in Arizona, named him Tonto. James Jewell objected to that because his uncle had owned a camp in northern Michigan called Kemosabe. And Trendle, that's right, and Chief Thunderbird used to entertain, the boys from schools used to go up to Camp Kemosabe, and Chief Thunderbird, who lived in the neighborhood in an Indian tribe or with the Indian tribe, used to come over to entertain the boys, and he was a bit of a wild one and would get drinking, and they'd have to send for the Indians to come and pick him up and take him back to wherever they lived, and they called him a Tonto because he was mischievous, badly behaved. And Jewell objected to the name Tonto, but he lost out on that argument. Tonto it was. It was the first sponsor or the advertising consultant for the Silver Cup Bread, Gordon Baking Company that made Silver Cup Bread. It was his idea that it was kind of silly for Tonto and the Lone Ranger to ride on the same horse. He said the Indian should have a horse of his own. So they decided they'd give him a horse, but they said, don't name him, have a contest. Have a contest, and we'll pick a name from the contest. And nobody knows to this day who the boy was in Chicago who named that horse Scout. And there are other stories about it, but I'm not going to take your time because I think you're about ready in the mood for the frosting on the cake. I do want to say this. The fellow who's going to play the Lone Ranger tonight was too young. He grew up with it as a boy. He got a chance to play it with Rube Weiss at Chuck Muir's restaurant one time. And we arranged to get the Lone Ranger gang together, including Fred Foy, who used to announce it. He lived on Long Island, a sound man from Florida, at the 10th annual convention of the Friends of Old Time Radio in Newark, New Jersey. And who was going to do the Lone Ranger? Well, they recommended this guy. This guy came in, flew in at the last, very busy, flew in at the last minute. He got there, made the show, and the idea was to have an open rehearsal. First time they'd ever done that, the Friends of Old Time Radio. Fred Flowerday staged it, and that was his idea. And I sat beside Jimmy Jewell's sister, Lee Allman, who was the original Miss Case in the Green Hornet, when he first opened his mouth in this rehearsal. And she slunk down in her chair, put her hand over her head, turned her face away, and I thought, what's the matter, Lee? Isn't he any good? She said, spectacular. And that night, on the broadcast, or pseudo-broadcast, I saw these fans of the Lone Ranger who belonged to the radio club, or the radio friends, just say, shake their heads. They couldn't believe he sounded so much alike. Lee Allen, one of the great disc jockeys of our town, now Lee Allen Reichel, that's his real name, in business for himself. You listen to him as the Lone Ranger. And now I'm going to turn it over to the boss of the evening, Mr. Rube Weiss. Ruben? Thank you.
He lies a lot. This man's not 85. He sounds as good as he did when he was working 30 and 40 years ago. He's got the same spirit, the same vibrant voice, and he remembers everything. He's got total recall. Thank you, Dick. Before we begin, ladies and gentlemen, I'll introduce the members of the cast, some of whom worked the original shows at WXYZ, both in the Maccabees Building and at the WXYZ studios on Iroquois and Jefferson. We're a little crowded here, but the actual studio on the 15th floor of the Maccabees wasn't that much larger. The sound effects were the live sound effects, horses' hooves, crashes, doors, whatever, are right here on the table. At the studio in the Maccabees Building, there was a separate room that was set aside only for sound effects. And they had probably the best sound effects crew in the country for this show and the Green Hornet and Challenge of the Yukon. There were four sound men, live sound men in each show, and another sound man who worked in the control booth, who ran all of the recordings and music. At this time, I'd like to introduce some of the people. This is Ed Wolfram, who bought all of this gear from Audio Graphics, and who spent a lot of time in editing the music and sound effects, and I think it's going to work and work just fine. The name of the show is called Summer Dawn. It was written by Tom Dougal, who worked as a writer at WXYZ for many years and also as an actor. And when the show went off the air, Tom taught at the Detroit Institute of Technology. He's still around, we're happy to say. This show was first produced on January 28th, 1952. So that was, 34 years ago. The members of the cast, if I can find my paper, I'll tell you who they are. And here they are. The Lone Ranger is, Dick put it so well, is played by Lee Allen, who worked at WXYZ for a lot of years as probably the top disc jockey in Detroit, and who now has his own recording studio as a producer of many radio commercials that you have heard thousands of times. Lee Allen. This is a tale of intrigue, of the Indians and renegades. And Summer Dawn is the young Indian girl in the script, and it's played by Liz Weiss. Liz worked the original, The Lone Ranger, for many years, the Green Hornet, Challenge of the Yukon, and is probably one of the most versatile voices in Detroit radio.
He has to say that because we're going home together.
Oh, all right. I think I had more, but... Also in the script is a character named Black Mike, who's a renegade. And he's played tonight by Rick Zipser. All right, and he brought his own black hat. In real life, Rick is a lawyer. And he has been an actor in his younger day. And we trained him to read five lines. And we hope he does well. The other guy who plays opposite him, another renegade. And most of the characters were... There was no in-between. They were either bad or they were good. And when they were bad, they were awful. You know, just terrible people. And naturally, we selected Sonny Elliott to play the other guy. You may do so at the appropriate time. There was always a good guy, young, juvenile in the cast, who was pure and simple. And the only guy I could find who was pure and very simple was my son, Leon Weiss, who is also an attorney and actor. Where is he? Oh, yes, I recognize him. There's another character in this, John Maitland, who is the storekeeper at the fort in the script. And one of the most versatile actors in Detroit, who played for many years on all of the shows at WXYZ, WWJ, WJR, is here. And Harry Goldstein. The ingenue in this script is Rose Parrish, who is the colonel's daughter at the fort. And we're happy to have with us Carol Vernon, an actress from Detroit. Carol? The part of Strongbow, an Indian who is the hero of the story, is played by an actor who has been in Detroit for many years. You've seen him on television and many commercials. He and I worked together last summer in the Sunshine Boys at the Attic Theater, and it's Whit Vernon. Our announcer is another voice that's most familiar to you in Detroit, who has done hundreds of industrial films, television and radio commercials, worked at WWJ as a staff announcer, Bud Haggard. Oh, I don't know where about you. I introduced Ed Wolfram from Audio Graphics. The sound tonight is being done by our sound team, husband and wife team, Jay and Mimi Kalish. And Jay is an attorney, and Mimi is my daughter. So, and she's good. She worked at WDIV. VTV for a while and does a good job. Let's see, is that everybody?
No, Tonto. You didn't introduce
Tonto. Me, Tonto. Kimo Sabe. Okay, hit it.
With the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty Hi-Yo Silver, the Lone Ranger. Before this exciting adventure, a word from our sponsor, General Mills, makers of Cheerios, the oat cereal that's ready to eat, Betty Crocker Mixes, and Wheaties, the breakfast of champions, present by special recording, the Lone Ranger. With his faithful Indian companion Tonto, the daring and resourceful masked rider of the plains led the fight for law and order in the early western United States. Nowhere in the pages of history can one find a greater champion of justice. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the thundering hoofbeats of the great horse Silver. The Lone Ranger rides again.
Come on, Silver. Let's go, big fellow. Are you Silver? Hooray!
In the light from the campfire, the girl seemed more Spanish than Indian. Her English was nearly perfect, for she had spent many years at the mission school. But as she spoke to the Lone Ranger and Tonto, the intensity of her emotion made her voice break now and then.
The Padre told me where I could find you and Tonto. I've come to you because you're the only man who has influence with my father. And even now, it may be too late.
Too late for what, Dawn?
My father, Stormcloud, means to attack Fort Clark.
Surely he wouldn't do anything so foolish.
His counsel has been bad. The old men have convinced him that the building of the fort north of the desert is only the beginning, that settlers will come soon.
No one will be allowed to settle in Indian territory.
There are only a few soldiers at the fort now, about 20. Stormcloud has been persuaded to attack before the garrison is reinforced.
But Dawn, your father's braves have only a few rifles. The soldiers have many, all the ammunition they need, and the walls of the fort to protect them. They'll be able to drive off any attack, and many of your young men will be killed.
It will not be like that. The night will be dark, and before the soldiers know what is happening, the Indians will be inside the fort. I shouldn't tell you this. I'm being a traitor to my father. But for the sake of one man, one of the soldiers, I cannot let him be killed.
Who is this man?
His name is Wayne.
Tonto know him. Their young lieutenant at Fort Gold, Wayne.
Yes, he saved my life once. I cannot forget that. And he was my friend. My mission name was Mary. He found out my Indian name was Summer Dawn, and he called me Mary Sunshine. He was my friend.
I understand how you feel about him, Dawn, but don't imagine you're being a traitor to your father. You're trying to keep him from making a terrible mistake. Tell me everything you know about his plans to attack the fort. How can the braves possibly get inside without the soldiers knowing about it?
There is a small gate in the stockade. It will be opened for them.
By whom?
Two men came to see my father. I heard them speak together. They promised the gate would be opened.
Two men from the fort?
No, their names are Black Mike and Duke Mantle.
Them plenty bad.
They're outlaws. They've had no chance of opening the gates of the fort.
I only know they gave their promise, and their reward was to be the gold in the colonel's office.
Could there be someone inside the fort who's working with them?
I don't know.
Have you any idea when the attack is supposed to be made?
It will be soon. You will talk with my father.
Before I can do that, I must warn the colonel.
Yes, that is good. And then we can tell Stormcloud the colonel has been warned. There is no chance for your attack to succeed.
When did Black Mike and Mantle come to your village?
Two nights ago. It has taken me till now to find you.
Then it might have happened last night, or it may happen tonight. We'll not be able to reach the fort before morning.
That is true.
Will you come with us?
Your word will be enough for the colonel.
But he'll want to talk with you, I'm sure of that.
I don't want to see him.
The colonel?
Lieutenant Wayne. The colonel has a daughter. Her name is Rose. The lieutenant is to marry her. He's forgotten me. I don't want to see him.
There's no need for you to do that.
Please.
You want to save his life?
And all their lives, and my father's life. For surely, if he does this thing, there will be a war, and the army will surely win.
Well, then?
If you feel it's necessary.
I do. There'll be questions I can't answer.
I shall ride with you then, to the fort.
Good. We'll saddle the horses, Tonto.
Yes.
It was rugged country the Lone Ranger, Tonto, and Summer Dawn rode through that night. But by morning, they had reached the foothills, and as the first light showed in the east, they saw their first sign of a disaster, a column of smoke rising toward the sky. They topped a final rise and drew rein. Below them stood the ruins of Fort Clark. Only the stockade remained. The buildings inside it were smoldering shells. The only sign of life were two horses grazing outside the wall.
Too late. I shall never return to my father now.
The Lone Ranger studied the fort through his binoculars.
I can see two men inside the walls. They're digging in the debris.
Them Indian?
No, Tonto. Take a look, Dawn.
Oh, now that the wolves have gone, the coyotes have come.
Are those the two men you saw talking to your father?
Yes, Black Mike and Duke Mantle.
Them look for gold.
Stay well behind us, Dawn. Let's go, Tonto.
The Lone Ranger and Tonto guided Silver and Scout down the slope and across the rolling plain at an easy lope. The horses were pulled to a walk as they neared the stockade, and finally to a stop just outside the walls. The main gates of the fort were wide open, and a short way beyond them, the two men were digging in the charred embers of what had once been the headquarters building.
Up with your hands!
A masked man and an Indian!
Get their guns, Tonto.
Now, wait a minute. Can we talk this over?
What's there to talk about?
Well, first, my partner and I had nothing to do with this. Happened here?
Are you sure of that?
Oh, it was Indians. We happened to know the colonel was holding a shipment of gold here. Wait until he could snare an armed escort for it.
You haven't found any gold, have you?
Yeah, no, but it's here somewhere. Help us find it, and we'll split it with you.
Dawn, come here, please.
Yes. These are the men.
Black Mike and Duke Mantle.
He knows us, Duke.
Now, this girl's the chief's daughter. You better warn these hombres to go easy, sister. You know how we stand with your father.
It was you who persuaded him to do this terrible thing.
That's a lie.
How did you manage to open the gates of the fort to the Indians?
Well, we had nothing to do with it.
Then how was it done?
Well, maybe these dead men can tell you.
You want me to tie up Mike and Duke?
Not yet, Tonto. They'll dig graves for every one of these soldiers before we leave here.
Yeah, that good.
The ground was soft, and by late afternoon, the outlaws had dug 20 shallow graves for the 20 soldiers who had been killed in the attack. When the last of them were covered, Mike and Duke were bound hand and foot. But neither Lieutenant Wayne nor the colonel's daughter had been found. And before leaving, the Lone Ranger and Tonto made a final search. The storehouse was the least damaged of the buildings. Though the roof had fallen in, three walls were still standing. And as the masked man and the Indian moved aside charred and fallen timbers, they heard a faint cry.
Tonto.
Me hear him.
A section of the roof had fallen intact and was leaning against one of the walls. The cry came from beneath it. The Lone Ranger and Tonto pulled back the roof section.
Pull it back.
And found a young soldier lying against the wall.
He's still alive.
Him hurt plenty bad.
A lieutenant.
It feller girl speak up. This Larry Wayne.
I'll carry him out in the open. Better get the medicine kit.
Me do that.
It was not long after the lieutenant's wounds had been bandaged that he opened his eyes. The first person he saw was Summer Dawn sitting close beside him.
Mary Sunshine.
Yes, Larry.
Your people. They came here.
They are not my people now.
Did they find Rose?
They may have taken her with them. She isn't here.
Have you looked? The cellar.
What cellar, Larry?
Underneath. Storehouse.
We've cleared all the debris out of the storehouse. There's no trap door leading to the cellar.
Outside.
Outside. I see. The rear wall, Tonto. The one that collapsed. The cellar door must be beneath it.
Yeah, me find him.
Don't let Larry talk too much, Dawn.
No, sir.
Dawn. He called you Dawn. I remember now. Summer Dawn.
The cellar door burst open. A man stepped out, his gun drawn.
They're masked.
Easy with that gun. We're friends.
It's Lone Ranger.
Lone Ranger?
Who are you?
My name is Maitland. John Maitland, a civilian.
I can see that.
The storekeeper for the post.
Is Colonel Parrish's daughter down there?
Yes. It's all right, Rose. These men are friends.
Friends? Are you sure? He's an outlaw.
No, I've heard of him. They call him the Lone Ranger.
Oh, my father.
Look around you, Miss Parrish.
Nothing. Nothing left. Were all of them killed?
Lieutenant Wayne is still alive.
Where? Where is he? Take me to him.
This way. The lieutenant isn't in any condition to talk much. I'd like you to tell me all you can about the attack on the fort.
There's nothing much I can tell you. When we first heard the Indians, they were inside the stockade. My father took me to the storehouse and told Mr. Maitland to hide me down in the cellar. He and I stayed there all through the fighting. When it was over, we tried to get out and couldn't. Oh, we thought we'd never get out.
Where did your father keep his gold?
What gold?
I understand your father had a large quantity of gold on hand.
Oh, that. A prospector left it here. It was to be taken to Fort Rogers the next time we sent supply wagons across the desert.
There's Larry beside the fire.
Oh, Larry. Darling, how are you? How badly are you hurt?
Just a moment. Just a moment, Maitland.
Yes?
What about the gold?
I don't know anything about it.
Not even where it was kept?
Well, I suppose it was in the headquarters building or in the colonel's cabin.
There's no sign of it in either place.
Then the Indians must have taken it.
I doubt that.
Who are those two men you have tied up over there?
Black Mike and Duke Mantle. We found them looking for the gold. It was they who arranged for the Indians to get inside the fort.
The dirty renegades, but how could they?
They must have had help from someone attached to the garrison.
A traitor? Here?
Yes, Maitland. Any ideas who it might have been?
That's unthinkable.
There was someone.
Those two men must know who he was.
They refused to say anything.
The mounds? Their graves?
Yes.
Let me count them. 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. If everyone were killed, there should be one more.
Lieutenant Wayne is still alive.
I've allowed for him. Someone must have escaped the massacre. The traitor you're speaking of. We must get word to Fort Rogers across the desert.
And our prisoners must be delivered there. But there are problems to be considered when it comes to crossing the desert. There are 8 of us. We only have 5 horses. Silver and Scout might be able to carry double. None of the others could.
That Indian girl. You're not bothering about her. Are you? What's she doing here anyway?
She brought us here, and she'll be traveling with us.
Hey, Kimosabe, you look. Their rider on hill to north. Maybe him scout for Storm Cloud.
If Storm Cloud comes back here, we'll all be murdered. Hey, the girl's riding out to meet the scout. Stop her!
Give me that gun!
We'll continue with our Lone Ranger adventure in just a moment.
Diving Doris is 13, and she is a diving queen. She can do a flip because she knows she's got go power from Cheerios. Yes, she's got go power.
There she goes.
She's feeling her Cheerios, Cheerios, Cheerios.
That's a mighty good idea for you. Just make sure you eat a big bowl of Cheerios and milk every breakfast, and you'll get go power, too. Because a Cheerios breakfast is loaded with proteins, vitamins, and minerals. The very things that help build healthy bodies, strong bones, good red blood, and muscles. Why, they'd be the sort of breakfast you'd go for even if they didn't taste so good. And they do taste delicious. Cheerios are a real oat cereal, already cooked with that delicious toasted oat flavor. So that's for you. Swell-tasting Cheerios and milk for go power. Eat them every morning and you'll hear...
She's feeling her Cheerios.
I'm the Lone Ranger Mystery Deputy. I can't tell you my name, but if you think you know me, you've got a good chance to win a big cash reward.
Now to continue. The Lone Ranger knocked Maitland's arm aside as he leveled his gun at Summer Dawn. His shot went wild, and in the next instant, the masked man had taken the gun away from the storekeeper.
I'd better keep this.
That girl's gone out to meet the scout.
What of it?
She's heard us talking. She knows we mean to get word of this massacre to Fort Rogers. She'll bring Stormcloud back here and we'll all be killed.
That girl is Summer Dawn. She's Stormcloud's daughter. She brought us a warning the fort was to be attacked. She did her best to prevent it. This morning when we found the fort in ruins, she said she'd never return to her father's lodge. She'll be coming back here alone. I'm sure of it.
The Lone Ranger was right. Summer Dawn talked with the Indian for only a few minutes and then raced back to the fort as he disappeared over the hill.
Soon we will have enough horses, Kimosabe.
That young brave is bringing them?
Yes, he is Strongbow, a friend.
Did he bring any word from your father's village?
The braves have feasted. Now they sleep. Soon they will ride again. We must be gone before then.
I'm wondering if the lieutenant will be able to ride.
I think so. If we ride tonight when it is cool, rest tomorrow, then ride it tomorrow night again. That will bring us to Fort Rogers.
We'll need a tent for him to rest in, and water enough for the whole trip. Let's see if we can find some kegs, Tonto.
Yeah, we look.
Watch the prisoners, Dawn.
I shall.
The Lone Ranger and Tonto had filled two kegs with water and had found an army tent in the wreckage of the storehouse by the time Strongbow returned with three Indian ponies. Then the party prepared to leave the fort. The outlaws were released from their bonds, but only to allow them to mount. Afterward, their hands were tied to the pommels of their saddles. Next, the Lone Ranger helped the lieutenant to his feet and realized at once he was too weak to ride alone.
I've changed my mind, Lieutenant. We'll use one of the ponies as a pack horse, have him carry the water and the tent. You'll ride with Silver and me.
You have a great horse, sir, but to carry double across the desert?
We'll not be moving fast. Silver can carry the extra weight.
I'd like to try to ride.
Perhaps tomorrow night. Up you go.
There was another slight delay when Maitland ran down to the cellar to get his money box. But at last, everyone was in the saddle. Strongbow placed a detaining hand on the bridle of Dawn's mount.
These people, not your people. It better you not go with them.
I must find a new home. In my father's face, I would always see the faces of the men he killed here last night.
Strongbow was not here.
I know. You've made yourself an outcast from the tribe because of me.
You ride with me far, far away. Find new hunting ground.
No, my friend.
Strongbow understand.
Goodbye.
The little cavalcade rode slowly out of the fort and into the desert. The Lone Ranger and the lieutenant were at the head of the column, and Tonto rode last to keep an eye on the prisoners. The white miles stretched before them, the wasteland broken only by great buttes and rock clusters. The ruined fort faded into the distance, with no sign of pursuit, and the moonlit desert seemed to embrace the little band and promise security. They made steady progress all through the cool hours of the night, but dawn came, and the first touch of the sun turned the barren land into a furnace. They stopped at a butte, 10 feet from its base. A shelf projected far out and promised shade through the day. There was no need for the tent. Lieutenant Wayne, very weak now, was lifted from the saddle and placed on a blanket. The women cooked breakfast, and as they ate, the Lone Ranger and Tonto talked in low tones.
The lieutenant is too weak to ride far tonight.
That's what Tonto think.
You'd better ride to the fort. Scout's still fresh. See if you can bring an ambulance out to meet us.
A good idea. Come here, Scout.
Where's Tonto going?
He's going to the fort.
He's deserting us?
I've sent him for an ambulance.
And we have to wait here until he gets back with it?
No, we'll start out again as soon as it's dark.
Oh, I see. Your prisoners want some water.
Here's a canteen. Don't let them have more than a few swallows.
Right. Here you are. The masked man says only a few swallows.
Yeah.
When are you going to do something?
When the right time comes.
What can you do? He took your gun.
I had another hidden down in the cellar. I got it when I went back for the cash box.
Yeah, but where's the gold?
In my cash box, of course.
Well, then all you have to do is put a bullet through the masked man.
Afterwards, we'll take all the horses and leave the lieutenant and the girls here.
We'll need the horses, that's sure. The eastern rim of the desert is a lot farther than the fort.
When are you going to take care of the masked man?
When it's dark.
Why wait till then?
He watches me as closely as he watches you. I'm going to wait until he has his hands full.
Well, he's watching you now.
I know. But I have the moment all figured out. When he picks up the lieutenant and starts carrying him to his horse, then I'm
Maitland,
going to...
Maitland?
Yes, sir?
I sent a few swallows.
That's all they're getting. Give me that canteen. Just leave everything to me, partners.
The long, hot hours of the day passed slowly, and it was with relief the little party watched the sun sink behind the western mountains. The Lone Ranger gave the order to break camp, and the moment came for departure. It was already dark. The masked man lifted Lieutenant Wayne in his arms, and Maitland's voice froze everyone in their tracks.
Now, mister, you're going to die.
Summer Dawn was tightening the cinch of her saddle. She turned to see Maitland's gun pointed directly at the Lone Ranger and Lieutenant Wayne.
So you were the traitor inside the fort, Maitland?
Yes.
And Duke and Mike were your confederates?
They made the bargain with Storm Cloud right again.
The gold is in your cash box.
You have the whole story, mister. And now...
With a wild cry, Dawn started running straight toward Maitland. He swung his gun to cover her, but before he could pull the trigger, his eyes widened in terror. The gun dropped from his grasp. He threw up his hands and pitched forward on his face. The light of the rising moon gleamed on the handle of a knife set squarely between his shoulder blades.
A knife! Who threw it?
Strongbow, see what happened. Strongbow, throw a knife.
Strongbow, where did you come from?
Me follow you.
You arrived just in time.
Man dead?
Yes.
He deserved to die.
I'll not argue with that.
You saved my life, Strongbow.
Your life not safe. Me come to warn you.
Stormcloud?
Scout find graves in fort. Follow tracks into desert. Him tell Stormcloud, me close to village, hear what chief say.
He's coming after us.
Him say, men who bury soldier go to Fort Roger now. Indian must stop him.
Leave me here, sir. You and the others can get away from them.
I'll stay with you, Larry.
We'll all stay.
I'll ride back. I'll try to reason with my father.
Well, that no good. Him swear to kill you.
Listen to me and look at this butte. On this side, it's possible to climb to the top. Up there, no bullet or arrow can hit us.
The Indians can climb up after us.
They'll have to do it single file, and one man can stop them.
What about the horses? Do we just leave them here?
Silver will lead them out of danger. Go on, boy.
Go!
At the Lone Ranger's command, Silver raced away from the butte, the other horses following him.
We can depend on Silver not to take them too far. We'll be able to call them back when we need them. Rose, Dawn, suppose you go first.
Yes, all right.
We will.
Rose and Dawn started climbing the steep side of the butte. The two prisoners were forced to follow, Strongbow keeping them covered every second with a six-gun the Lone Ranger had given him. Last came the Masked Man and Lieutenant Wayne, and before they reached the top, Stormcloud and his braves swept out of the night. The lieutenant was lifted to safety just in time, and the Lone Ranger pulled himself up after him, took cover, and returned the Indians' fire. Storm Cloud realized the butte must be stormed and ordered his braves up the side. But there was only one break in the sheer wall, and the Masked Man's rapid fire drove them back.
Good work, sir.
We can hold out as long as our ammunition does.
Strongbow see cloud of dust to south.
It's Tonto and the ambulance you asked for.
The driver and Tonto, they'll be killed.
We'll try to warn them there's trouble.
They aren't stopping at all.
It would take more than an ambulance and one horse to make that cloud of dust.
That's right. It stretched back long way.
It's soldiers.
It must be a whole squadron.
The colonels acted quickly.
My father means to stand and fight.
There can only be one end to it, Dawn.
I know. Those who live by the sword must die by the sword.
To stand and fight was a rash decision for Stormcloud to make. He paid for it with his life. And all the other leaders who had urged him to attack Fort Clark were killed during the Battle of the Buttes. The Indians who survived the battle and surrendered to Colonel Ashley were marched to Fort Rogers. There they were placed in a stockade, and there they stayed until General Wilkes arrived to confer with the colonel. The Lone Ranger was summoned to their conference, then Summer Dawn and Strongbow, and finally a great council was held inside the stockade. On the following morning, Rose Parrish, who was sitting beside Lieutenant Wayne's bed in an upper room of the post hospital, pointed out the window.
Oh, look, Larry. The Indians are leaving the stockade.
So they finally signed a treaty.
Oh, they must have. They must have elected someone as their chief the general can trust.
I wonder who it might be.
I wonder who that can be.
Why not open the door and find out?
Yes, Lieutenant, sir.
Rose.
Summer Dawn. Come in, my dear.
Good morning.
Hello, Merry Sunshine.
The sun is shining today.
It's shining in your face. I've never seen you look so happy.
I am happy. And before I go, I want to wish you two all the happiness in the world.
Thank you.
Go? Where are you going?
Home.
With your people? But I thought you never meant to return.
Things will be different now.
I hope so.
Well, who's your new chief going to be?
The Braves have chosen Strongbow.
Wonderful.
That's great.
And Strongbow has chosen me.
My dear, my very best wishes.
Well, what do you think of that? Little Mary Sunshine getting married.
Little Mary Sunshine was a child, Lieutenant Wayne. I am a woman, and wise enough now, I hope, to help Strongbow teach our people the ways of peace.
I'm not worried about that.
Nor am I, for there's someone else who'll be helping us both. He's promised. And how can we fail when we can count on the wisdom and courage of the Lone Ranger?
Hail Silver! Away!
¶¶